This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD2. We're online at will.illinois.edu. I'm Celeste Quinn. Glad you could join us this afternoon. On the program today, we're going to take a look at clinical medical trials. They are a multi-billion dollar industry with 20 million Americans enrolled. Journalist Alex O'Mara says clinical trials affect everyone's health. In his book, Chasing Medical Miracles, The Promise and Perils of Clinical Trials, he says, trials are the nascent form of our healthcare system. They are the first stage of tomorrow's new medicines, devices, and procedures. Each success and failure, every story, is a window into the kind and quality of treatment you will either receive or be subjected to in the years to come. Alex O'Mara has participated in a clinical trial. In an effort to cure his type 1 diabetes, he received a transplant of islet cells from several cadaver pancreases. Listeners, I look forward to your questions and comments for our guest, Alex O'Mara. Join the discussion with a phone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Our toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Alex O'Mara is a freelance journalist who has worked for many media organizations, including the City News Bureau of Chicago, Newsday, and the Baltimore Sun. You'll find our guest online at www.alexomara.com, and he spells his name O-M-E-A-R-A, alexomara.com. The book, Chasing Medical Miracles, is published by Walker. Again, our phone number is 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Alex, good to talk with you. How are you?
Yeah, I'm fine. Thank you, Celeste, for having
sure,
me.
Sure, my pleasure. In the introduction to this book, Chasing Medical Miracles, you tell readers you're not pro or con when it comes to clinical trials. What was your goal in writing this book?
My goal was to find out about trials and then communicate that as part of, as a participant in a trial. I never really thought about it much, and you know, I was very when I became a participant, wanted to be cured of diabetes, and that was pretty much my focus. But as a reporter for a long time, I started looking at it, and the numbers jumped out at me: the 20 million Americans enrolled, the $24 billion a year industry, the fact that that had tripled in the last decade, and it seemed to me that there was something going on that was beyond just a medical phenomenon, but was almost a cultural phenomenon, and it seemed to have happened very quietly, and that piqued my curiosity, and so I wanted to find out more about it. The more I found out, the more interesting the story became, frankly, and so I thought that it would be a story that would be interesting to people who don't know much about clinical trials, even though they might be enrolled in one, they may have heard of one, or come across one somehow, and I think there's a great many people who have. So my point was just to put out there what was happening and had happened up to this point so people would have context about what they are involved in or what they might get involved in the future.
Yeah, and I quoted you in my introduction, and that's, I think, why it's important that we better understand this story. That's quite a statement you make. Each success and failure is a window into the kind and quality of treatment we'll receive or be subjected to in the years to come.
Well, that's very true. There's, you know, things have been developed because of clinical trials, such as heart stents and insulin pumps, and chemotherapy was developed because of clinical trials. It wasn't just that someone thought it up. As someone told me, a bioethicist I interviewed, he said, people think that medical discovery is some guy in a lab with a beaker, you know, and the moment comes and he says, aha. And that's not how it happens. It's a grind. You grind it out over years, sometimes testing things on sometimes hundreds of thousands of people to get the results that you want, that you have a stable thing that you can then give to people to take for the rest of their lives. When polio was tested in 1955, 300,000 people took inoculated 1.8 million children, and polio was cured, and it was a very, very dramatic occurrence. It was the biggest clinical trial in history and still is to this day. What happened also, though, in that clinical trial was that 220 children got infected with polio and 10 of them died. The result of one laboratory that had shipped a tainted batch of vaccine. So what that reveals is that although the medical discovery is worthwhile and great and wonderful, it brings up problems in the process, perhaps in where the laboratories are managed and how things are done, and that's part of the story that should be made aware, that just coming up with the cure or the treatment is not enough. It's how it's managed and how it's distributed and things like that, and clinical trials reveal all that. So truly, everything that we get treated with does have to go through a clinical trial, and that's the bottleneck through which all things pass and will either come to us or not come to us, and sometimes come to us in a different form because of what the trial revealed. Mm.
What's the future for islet cell transplantation in the treatment of type 1 diabetes?
It's a crapshoot right now. When I had it done, I was one of about 300 people in the world to have the procedure done. Now it's about 500. The New England Journal of Medicine put out an article shortly after I received the transplant saying that it wasn't quite working past a couple of years for people. And that was sort of depressing because I had just had it done. It's like getting a new car and finding out it's been recalled. It looks like it's not as successful as it may have been, but there is hope because part of the problem with transplanting islet cells into a diabetic is it's like an organ transplant. You have to take immunosuppression drugs and a lot of medications. And it might be that those medications are harming the cells and a person's body to the extent where they can't support the cells. Stem cell research, on the other hand, if they can transplant stem cells that are grown from a person's own body and then grow islet cells from that and put them into someone's liver who has diabetes, as they did with me, there won't be the issue of having to take rejection drugs, which could make it a very viable therapy for curing diabetes. We only would have known that, of course, by going through the process that I went through to find that out.
What are the risks of this kind of a trial for folks like you and others?
For me, it's pretty risky. You know, a friend of mine, when I was going through this, said, "Boy, this all seems rather extreme," because I had to, they take islet cells, which are from cadaver pancreases, and they put them in a bag, this yellow sludgy solution, and then they infuse it into your liver. The procedure takes a half an hour. It's not a big deal. But to get to that point was a lot of screening. I got a lump removed from my lung because I had a growth. They didn't know what it was. If I had taken immunosuppression, it may have been something that could have harmed me, so I opted to have it removed. So they removed the lobe of my lung. And then the procedure itself is nothing, but then afterwards, the follow-up care and the time spent on some fairly heavy immunosuppression and then long-term light immunosuppression, I've got a 90% higher chance of contracting lymphoma and other things. But the point is that we don't really know the risks because it's a clinical trial. When the doctor was telling me what was going to happen in the trial, I was asking him what happens then, like you ask any doctor. And he was giving me answers like, well, we'll find out, that's what we'll see. And then I realized, it's experimental. Mm-hmm. We don't know. Mm-hmm. That's the point, you know? So, I used to joke around. I said, okay, when I signed the consent form, I said, okay, so if my head explodes in 20 years, I really can't complain. And they said, no, you really can't. So the risks are known. Some of them are known, but there are others that might not be known, but we might find out about them through me and other people in the years to come.
Yeah. Now, for someone like yourself, this could benefit you personally, but also it could benefit all these folks with diabetes. Type 1 diabetes is nothing to fool around with.
No, type 1 diabetes is nothing to fool around with, and the extremity through which I went to seek a cure was, for some people, a little beyond the pale. But having diabetes, I told another friend of mine about this. I said, if I had to light my hair on fire every day to cure diabetes, I would do it because it's that bad. I'd live with it for 30 years and have done a wonderful job of managing it. I have no complications. I have no issues, and that was one of the criteria. But, it's a leading cause of kidney failure, the leading cause of blindness, the leading cause of amputation, one of the leading causes of heart disease. It's, I think, the fourth leading killer in the United States. It doesn't get a lot of attention for more dramatic diseases, frankly, because it's a chronic, ongoing disease. It's not a big, you get the diagnosis and then this happens and then that happens. It's not a movie of the week kind of thing because it's so pervasive. So many people have it, and it seems so just by the book every day. But it does take a very large toll. And people don't die of diabetes. They die of the complications. So doing those numbers to figure out what people are dying from and suffering from is not as clear-cut as some other conditions might be.
Mm. Journalist Alex O'Meara is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking with him this afternoon about clinical medical trials. They're a multi-billion-dollar industry with 20 million Americans enrolled. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, if you'd like to join us, 333-9455. And we also have that toll-free number if you'd like to join us on the toll-free number, that number 800-222-9455. So $24 billion go into clinical trials annually. Where does the money come from and where does it go?
Good question. The $24 billion comes from companies that are trying to develop drugs, devices, and treatments, and they have to pay a lot of money to do that. It once was that drugs, devices, and things were developed at universities in general and then would be perfected, and then a company would come in after they had been developed and perfected, and it would go on the market. And that model has sort of flipped. In the 80s and 90s, a class of business called clinical research organizations grew up. And what clinical research organizations do generally is they run clinical trials. They're contractors. So Pfizer or Merck or, you know, my friend Bob wants to make a pill that will make people taller. You know, so he will go to the clinical research. He has the idea. He has the drug. He will go to the clinical research organizations and say, I need this tested on people, and they'll pay them a lot of money to test it, a great deal of money, billions in some cases, over a very long process that can go up to 10 years. And then those companies spit out the results. Hopefully they're the results they want. About 8 times out of 10, they're not the results anyone wants, and the drug or the treatment does not go any further. So there's a great deal of money spent on something that never comes to market. But the FDA approval process is fairly stringent and fairly lengthy and expensive. So that's where a lot of the money is generated, is basically private enterprise perfecting treatments and drugs.
Mm. Let's take a telephone call now from a listener in Charleston waiting for us on line one. Hi.
Hi. Good afternoon.
Hello.
I heard you just speaking about the FDA's involvement.
Yes.
There was a attempt to get the Supreme Court to preempt any lawsuit against a drug company if the FDA had approved their drug. And I don't think that is going. It had passed or will pass. But is the FDA's involvement as a government agency, or is it involved in the profit sharing of these drugs that it puts out? The reason I ask is because it seems if the clinical trials are meant to be the last hurdle before a drug reaches the population, it seems like that we dropped the ball somewhat. In the last 5 years, a lot of the drugs, and unfortunately I can't remember any specifically, but they seem to be recalled, and they were widespread use and had pretty severe complications. So what recourse does the population have? I mean, can we ask for more, better control from the FDA, or does there need to be another agency looking at how the FDA is scrutinizing these drugs? Because as I understand it, the FDA is headed by someone who is from the pharmaceutical agency, and there already seems to be a conflict of interest there. Sorry for the long question. Hopefully you can speak to that.
You raised lots of good issues there.
Well, it is a very interesting question. The FDA is an independent. It's a U.S. government agency that oversees clinical trials. There are issues with the FDA that people think it's as simple as them deciding whether to be one thing or another. I mentioned earlier that the number of people enrolled in clinical trials has pretty much tripled in the last 10 years. That's also been the last 10 years of very little regulation. Because of the administration and the mood of the country, we did not regulate very strongly, as we're seeing now, because of the economic problems we're having. In that same period of time, with so many more people enrolled in clinical trials, so many more clinical trials taking place, and in a mood of deregulation, the FDA took a lax attitude, not because of they were sharing any profits, not because it was an evil conspiracy, but just because that's the way it went. FDA investigates on-site maybe 1% of clinical trials taking place, which is incredibly low. There is part of the problem for that is that they just don't have the physical manpower to oversee the growth of this industry, which has basically escaped a lot of public scrutiny. And the FDA needs more help in doing this. Doctors and researchers need to be more diligent, but they're not being asked to be more diligent by the FDA because, again, because of the numbers and because it's such a large industry. I think there is influence over the FDA by pharmaceutical companies and drug device manufacturers and things like that, the same way that there is influence over the Environmental Protection Agency by oil companies, in the same way there's influence over, you know, other companies by the auto industry and things like that. But I don't think it's anything more than that. I don't think it's anything more insidious on behalf of the FDA. Legally, clinical trials are in a very strange place. You can sue. You sign a consent form when you agree to a clinical trial, and if it doesn't work out, you can sue, is supposed to be how it works. It doesn't, chiefly because of the consent form, but also because clinical trials are not tried as clinical trials in court. They're tried as medical malpractice. The problem with that is they're not medicine. They're research. So you've got a gap there that the law does not address. What you normally have is if something happens like Vioxx and other drugs, class action lawsuits will come forward. They'll get hauled into court, and then they'll settle, or the lawsuit won't go forward because it's specious. It's the legal system that has to suss this out in civil cases, not in criminal cases. So there's definitely a lack of not just regulatory oversight for people who conduct clinical trials, but a lack of recourse for people who sign a consent form and then have to pick up the pieces when something goes wrong. And not that they are suffering because of what the clinical trial did, but because of something that went wrong during the study, something they perhaps were not told, information that was withheld so that we're not fully informed. And those are issues that are still, I think, shaking out and taking place, and they're going to change probably in the next couple of years a great deal. I know that the Obama administration is seeking to disallow companies who conduct clinical trials to hide behind trade secrets in not releasing the results of clinical trials. Right now, a company can do 10 clinical trials, again, on a pill that's going to make you taller. They'll do 10 clinical trials. 8 of those trials will show that nothing happened. 2 of them will show that people got a little taller. They put the 8 in a drawer. They don't have to tell anyone about those trials, and they can publish the 2 clinical trials that got the results they wanted. They can cite not having to release the other results as trade secrets. So that has been somewhat overstepped, probably, and used a little bit too generously by industry, and that might come around where they can't do it, so all clinical trials will be made available in some form for public scrutiny. But again, we're talking about massive, massive numbers of documents and findings. It's an industry. It's an enormous industry that has grown up on its own without any clear oversight of one regulatory agency or person, because no one expected it to grow like this. And it's become this thing that now has to be somehow reined in a little bit or overseen in a much more stringent way than anyone ever thought possible.
Yeah, and I've got a couple of other callers waiting to talk with us, and I want to get to them pronto. But
okay.
I do want to mention our first caller this afternoon also mentioned preemption, which I think is very interesting. And this is if a drug is approved by the FDA and it harms someone, the drug maker shouldn't be sued or cannot be sued. You want to just give us a quick comment on preemption?
Yeah, that, again, I think has come out because of the legal situation that doesn't quite adequately address clinical trials and putting it off on the FDA. But, again, the FDA is this poor group of people who doesn't have the manpower to enforce what they're supposed to enforce. So a lot of the time. So that makes it difficult, and industry can do that because it should be that the FDA is the person responsible for letting something out if it harms somebody. But the reality is that no one can possibly oversee and do due diligence on something that's just this big. So, again, it falls in the middle, and I think that will be addressed in coming years, hopefully, by the legal system, by business itself, which will have to police better, and by industry. I think businesses have gotten away with what they're able to get away with, and that's fine because no one ever told them it was wrong. So any business or anyone from a two-year-old to a corporation is going to always get away with what they can get away with. But now times have changed a little bit, and they might have to do a little bit more policing where they will self-regulate to the extent where they can meet the FDA halfway, and things will improve, hopefully.
Let's take another call now. A listener in Champaign County on line two. Hi.
Hi. I recollect that the decimation of the FDA started as well far back as the Reagan administration with the deregulatory notion. And one of the economic things that has been criticized by many is this fee-based system that the FDA has gone to, where the big pharma and the companies pay a certain amount for the studies that the FDA does do, which are fewer than the studies that that are done by the companies themselves. And as you say, they can only have to report the ones they want to report. But I wanted, you mentioned that only the FDA only overlooks in any systematic way clinical trials in 1% of the cases? Did I hear?
They only physically will go to, they've only physically gone to locations to inspect in case of there's been a regulatory report of something. They will only physically go out to 1% of all clinical trials that are conducted.
Yeah. We have a local instance of the oncology unit at the major hospital in town here was, and I don't remember the details right off the top of my head, they were forced to suspend their clinical trials.
That's not quite right.
No, okay.
They couldn't enroll any new people in certain trials, and I don't have it right in front of me either. Mm. But they didn't suspend the trials.
So
they couldn't take any new people into the trial until things got straightened out, but they weren't shutting the trial down.
There was a crackdown some years ago with the University Virginia Commonwealth University Hospital, with Johns Hopkins and a few other big research institutions, where the FDA came in and said, "Let's look at your stuff." It was sort of a surprise raid, if you will, if you want to even term it that. This was 8-9 years ago, and found that there were a lot of regulatory issues that were not synced up. IRBs, institutional review boards, which oversee or independent groups that are supposed to oversee clinical trials, did not have their acts together at some of these institutions. And so the FDA just told these institutions, we're going to shut you down. We're going to stop your clinical trials from enrollment, not stop them from continuing, but stop them from enrollment until you get your act together. And what that generally meant was it didn't mean that, you know, these institutions were out there harming people or anything like that. What it meant was there was a real an atmosphere that could allow for abuse because there was poor oversight, and they pulled that together, and that served as a warning to a great many other institutions. And that's only happened once that I'm aware of.
That's what I was going to ask you, is how uncommon or common that is, and you say it's extremely uncommon, I guess.
It's not very common. I know Johns Hopkins had its funding threatened to be pulled, which is a massive amount of money that comes from the feds because of an incident when a woman died at a clinical trial at Johns Hopkins that turned out to be someone at Johns Hopkins who was performing it but not under the aegis of the university. Frankly, the fallout for researchers when something goes horribly wrong is not that bad, because it'll be civil. It'll be a monetary settlement, and it'll be undisclosed, and it'll be quiet, you know, and that does not provide for a lot of fallout, so people will point their fingers and say, you really shouldn't do this, or you should have done that, so business can go ahead as usual. And, you know, I don't want to make it seem like most clinical trials are out there harming people. There is what has grown up probably since Reagan, and things have been lax in regulation in this particular area, is that the possibility is higher unless there was more regulatory oversight. There are a lot of rules and regulations. There's a ton of rules and regulations. No one's arguing with that, and industry hates having to jump through all those hoops. But you can pass all the laws you want. If you don't have the resources to enforce them, they're really not that meaningful. And now we're sort of in this, I think, this middle ground where nothing bad has really happened. I mean, some bad things have happened, but the atmosphere has gotten so loose that something bad could happen, and that needs to be reined in before something significant happens, like Vioxx or something else, but having a more direct effect on people's lives and mortality?
The idea of having a litigious solution, it seems to be not the best way, but I don't know what the other options are, and it seems to me that particularly the case you just mentioned of Vioxx is the cooking of the books was so repugnant and so bad in that instance that it seems to me that there ought to be possibly a recourse for
the other option would
criminal
be
action. I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
The other option would be to make new law, frankly. To get something before the Supreme Court or some court that will say this is a unique case. It is not medical malpractice, but it is a separate, unique instance of harm being done in the needs of research despite consent. And that's a very narrow hole to fill. So I know there are some lawyers who are working to achieve that. But in the meantime, frankly, there's not a lot of pressure on the legal system to do that because the legal system is getting some good paydays from bringing civil suits. So, it's, again, not people having a conspiracy and sitting in a room and doing this stuff, but this is the way the system has evolved.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today, journalist Alex O'Meara, author of Chasing Medical Miracles, The Promise and Perils of Clinical Trials. Let's take another call now. A listener in Sycamore, line 4. Good afternoon.
Yes, good afternoon. I'm quite intrigued to hear that your guest participated in a trial to cure diabetes. Now, I've been pretty much of the feeling, probably very cynically, that diabetes is almost the ideal disease for drug companies because they can produce all kinds of treatments for it that don't actually cure it and make an awful lot of money selling these. And since it sounds from what you're saying like the drug companies fund most of these clinical trials, I'm eager to hear your comments about both of those. That the trial you were in was actually to cure, not just to treat and maintain the disease, and what are your feelings are about drug companies funding clinical research mainly for coming up with treatments but not cures. And I'll hang up and listen.
Okay. The clinical trials, all the clinical trials done for islet cell transplantation were done at universities and research institutions and not commercial CROs centers. Part of the reason was that you couldn't have a large number of people. You needed people who were diabetic. You couldn't do phase one, phase two. You had to jump to phase three and just do treatment on someone who had the condition. So it's a pretty narrow group of people. There was no need to hire companies to do the basic screening of a large number of people and then boiling it down and then doing massive amounts of data. Because like I said, when I got my treatment, I was one of about 300. Now it's one of about 500. So the protocol for the islet cell transplantation was developed in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, and then exported to several centers, including the University of Virginia in Charlottesville, where I had mine done, so that people could develop centers for cures. Most of the money that paid for my particular transplant came from a private donor whose children were diabetic, and he wanted to see a cure for this. At the same time, drug companies and other companies did donate medications, immunosuppression and other medications, to see how they might work with me because they were doing sort of a mini trial to see if maybe if this was cured, they could be the supplier of the medication that people would have to take. So as far as clinical research focusing on treatment rather than cure, I think both goes on at once. I think, yes, of course, there is money in treatment, but again, I don't think that the aim of clinical research is to not cure something. I think they'd love to cure it if they could get to it. But in the meantime, the people who have it, 20 million people with diabetes, 2 million of whom have type 1 diabetes in this country, it's lucrative, but they also need treatment at the same time, and better forms of treatment are always good to extend life. So I don't think they're foregoing cure to focus just on treatment to make money. I think that's a little overstated. But they do a lot of research to provide better treatment for all kinds of chronic diseases, whether it's cancer, whether it's Alzheimer's, whether it's diabetes, and the list goes on and on.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, journalist Alex O'Meara. We're talking about clinical medical trials this afternoon. Listeners, you can join us with a question, a comment. Join us with a phone call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone and take another call from, I think this is our first caller from Charleston. Back with us again with a follow-up. Hi.
Hi. Thank you. My follow-up question is, I see a potential correlate. I was hoping maybe with your knowledge of pharmaceutical that you could help paint this picture. The mortgage crisis that we're in right now seemed to have precipitated from 1999 upheaval of an old law passed after the 1920s, the Depression, right? And it was that you couldn't treat mortgage-backed securities as other things and trade them around and reinvest them. That was overturned, and now you have this mortgage crisis. I was wondering if there's something similar in the legislature that happened that may have precipitated where we are with some of these drugs, making it past some of those, you know, phase two and three clinical trials, but still end up causing a lot of damage. Is there anything in the legislature that has passed that could, you know, correlate back to the banking fiasco that we're in with the mortgages? Thank you very much for taking my call.
I don't believe there's a specific tipping point as far as the law was passed and that opened the floodgates for clinical trials. The reason there are so many clinical trials, the reasons are there are more people wanting more drugs. And I know pharmaceutical companies and device manufacturers make more, but they meet a demand that they somehow help fuel, but they did not create. The number of prescriptions that the average American takes from 1970 to now has almost doubled for no other reason than it just has. What also happened in the 60s and 70s was there was a real fracturing of medical care. You used to go to one doctor, and you would see the doctor, and he would, you know, help you. And if really something extraordinary happened, you would go to a specialist. Well, with a lot of special interests and other groups asserting themselves as groups apart from the populace, what happened was that there were more people around the bedside. There were lawyers around the bedside. There were specialists around the bedside. There were homeopathic people around the bedside. So there wasn't one central place, and that engendered more research on more things for more individuals. For instance, we have so many different kinds of antidepressants because when people took Paxil in the old days or lithium, they had very bad side effects, and they didn't want those side effects. So people who made other drugs for antidepression saw this and said, oh, we can do this, we can do that. So I think that those numbers came because of that. The reason that things like Vioxx and more things are happening is I don't know if there's a thing that you can point to because of legislation that allows it to happen, because it certainly doesn't. It is, again, I think, the lack of regulatory oversight, even though there is no lack of regulation to make sure these things don't happen. It's harder to dot the I's and cross the T's when you're bailing water just to stay afloat. So I think that's a large part of it. And the legal system is such a way that there is relatively little danger of anything happening. I say relatively. Of course, civil suits and those things, stock market, having your stock beat up when you do have a lawsuit is not exactly wonderful. But it is not a great loss. It's not a criminal charge. It's nothing like that in light of something going wrong. So the other thing is that a lot of research is being contracted out to people who are not intimately involved with the project. So Vioxx is being worked on, or some other drug, even one being developed now, is being worked on by somebody who's a contractor who is just carrying out an order, doing what they're supposed to do, doing a very good job of it, and then all the data comes together. It's a very complicated process, whereas I think previously in the 80s even, and maybe even in the 70s, the process was not so complicated because there were not so many hands on the project. Now you've got a great many hands on the project because of how complicated and diffuse the system has become.
Yeah. Describe for us, if you would, a place in Tempe, Arizona, MDS Pharma Services.
MDS Pharma Services. I did a chapter in Chasing Medical Miracles about guinea pigs, people who go and volunteer for clinical trials for money. And this is the thing you always see made fun of in sitcoms and, you know, the college people who go and their skin turns green or something because they need to buy beer. So I went up there to volunteer. I did not go through with the clinical trial because that would have been wholly unethical, but I wanted to see what the process was like. I went up, and they screen you, first of all, to make sure that you get instructions, first of all, beforehand. And this was to test an epilepsy drug. It was a phase one trial, which means you tested on healthy people to find out what a safe dose is. And I went up. They told me no caffeine, no nicotine, no, not even any aspirin, very pristine medically before I got up there for 2 weeks beforehand. At the time, however, I was taking all of my immunosuppression and high blood pressure medication because of the immunosuppression. I was taking, I had a toothache at the time. I was taking Vicodin. And I think then I switched to Percocet. And then I was on antibiotics. So as I told somebody, I was on more drugs than Elvis at the time. And I went up to be screened, and they took my blood, and they weighed me, and they did all this other stuff with all these other people, and they called me back the next day, and I passed the screening, which is almost impossible. There's no way that I could have passed. There's no way they couldn't have found something. So what that signaled to me is companies that recruit and need people are being paid for those people, and they really want those people because it means money, and so they kind of rush it through. And I don't know how widespread this is. I would guess it's not fairly uncommon, you know, that this happens, that people are screened. Either they're not screened well or results are not looked at. I have no idea what the case is. It just surprised me in my research that something like that happened. A lot of people do clinical trials for money, and there's a very good website called Just Another Lab Rat. That shows you how you can do it, how much it'll pay, where good sites are, how to prep for the screening, all that kind of stuff. People make a living at it.
Yeah.
And that was my little experience doing that. It was very bizarre.
It was interesting that I learned that there are ad agencies specializing in recruitment for trials.
Yeah, it's the most amazing thing that happened to me when I was researching Chasing Medical Miracles was the industrialization of medical testing. I think we most people have this image that it's guys in lab coats, you know, doing this thing to better humanity, which they certainly are, but it is a massive industry where recruitment is a huge part of it, because out of you may get 1% or half of 1% of all the people you recruit, because you have to screen them medically. You have to screen them for certain criteria before you can bring them in. And then you've got to get them to stay in the trial. If it's not a paid trial, that can be a struggle, because you can drop out of the trial anytime you want. There's no one to keep you from doing that. A great many people will enroll in a clinical trial for treatment. And this number actually has gone up almost 17% in the last 6 months because of the recession. People have lost their jobs, they've lost their health insurance, and they think that a clinical trial is an option for medical treatment. And I will say that some people do get treated. I got treated. And some people do receive treatment for whatever condition they have. But clinical trials are never medical treatment. They are always research. They are always a data collection activity. The idea that it is treatment is there's a bioethicist I interviewed. His name is Paul Applebaum, and he calls it the therapeutic misconception, which is that a clinical trial will help you somehow. And this is promulgated by researchers who are in a white coat, and they have a stethoscope, and they're telling you this, that, and the other, and you think of them as a doctor. Well, at the time that you're talking to them, they're scientists. They're researchers. They're not going to hurt you, but the first need they have is to prove the thesis of whatever they are testing and not to cure you of the sniffles or whatever it might be. That might happen, but that's not the point. And that's a very important thing for people to keep in mind if they're considering a clinical trial, that it is not treatment, that it is experimentation.
Journalist Alex O'Meara is our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author of Chasing Medical Miracles, The Promise and Perils of Clinical Trials. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, if you've got a question, a comment, 333-9455 is the number in the Champaign-Urbana area if you'd like to join us. We also have a toll-free number, that number, 800-222-9455. The number of people enrolled in clinical trials around the world rose 300% in the space of a decade. I want to take on a couple of issues here before we run out of time.
Mm-hmm.
This growing number of people who are taking part in clinical trials, that's one thing. It it's risen so dramatically, 300% in the space of a decade. That's one point. Then the other point is this is involves 20 million people in the United States, 50 million worldwide. And we have more people than ever before are enrolling in clinical trials as subjects, but demand is outstripping supply. What is the demand, and what's the industry doing to address the issue, and does this get us into global clinical trials?
Western companies and U.S. as well as Europe and other Western industrialized nations have aggressively started exporting clinical trials to test them on other populations, most notably Eastern Europe and Africa. I went to Uganda to research this book because I wanted to find out what it was like for people who were poor, why they enrolled in clinical trials, and how that all functioned. The remarkable thing about needing to do that is when the FDA approves a device or a treatment or a drug, you can test everything you want in other countries as long as you adhere to the standards of the host country or to the Helsinki Declaration, which is a declaration of intent for clinical trials that was drafted in the 60s. The problem with adhering to the standards of another country is a lot of countries have very poor standards. So you can adhere to the standards of, Bulgaria or somewhere, and the standards are almost non-existent. So that means that consent might be a little slippery. I know people in Uganda, I've interviewed them, who speak Luganda, which is besides English, a native tongue in Uganda, and were signing consent forms in English without being able to read them. People are told that they will receive treatment for things or they'll receive incentives if they would just take this pill or this treatment or undergo these tests. The people in other countries are desperate for medical treatment. Many of them haven't seen a doctor. The per capita annual spending on health care in Uganda is $1 a year. So you have a doctor who shows up, who's giving you pills, who says they want to help you, and a lot of people are like, yeah, this is great. I talked to a guy who ran an AIDS clinic in Kampala, and he treats about 30,000 people a year. His budget for the entire year is $250,000, and his point was, I'll take a clinical trial. I want a clinical trial. I need the meds, I need the resources they can bring, and that's a legitimate concern when you're trying to treat people and you have nothing. So companies that are conducting clinical trials are aware of this, of course, and they go and they can get more people more easily to enroll in trials. There have been some outrages. There have been some people killed as a result of companies either not overseeing things well or doing a poor job. In Nigeria, they are taking the executives of one major drug company to criminal court over some children who died in a clinical trial that they say they exploited the children. So it's a very slippery slope of what to do when we're turning a lot of the unindustrialized world into medical sweatshops for the industrialized world. They're testing AIDS drugs in Uganda right now very heavily, very heavily. For years, malaria and tuberculosis have killed more people in Uganda than AIDS ever did. And I was talking to a friend of mine there, and I said, do they test for tuberculosis and malaria drugs here? And he said, no, not really. And the reason is there's no tuberculosis or malaria in the industrialized world. There's no money to be made. There's no point to do anything. So unless you can pay for it, why bother? There is AIDS in the industrialized world, so you have a market once you've developed the drug or the treatment plan in the non-industrialized world. So that's what's taking place. It's unfortunate. It's not right. Part of the reason that it's taking place is because people in the industrialized world, they want their treatments, they want their drugs, they want their stuff, and there just isn't enough people here to test them all. Mm. And the regulations are tough and the cost is very high, and companies that develop medicines they have stockholders, they have responsibilities to those stockholders, and they have to make money at the end of the year, and this is the way that helps them do that. So it all makes cold calculating sense, but unless you get down to the fact that we're talking about people. Testing stuff that they may not know what it is, or if they do, they might not care and take it anyway just because it's something. So it's a very crisis situation that is not being paid a lot of attention to right now.
Yeah. One last question, because we're out of time and we've got a call I can't take because we are out of time.
Okay.
But what's the risk to the corporate folks who are engaged in this, because one day couldn't they be facing a publicity disaster? We've seen it in from time to time. We see it in clothing and in other things.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is a risk for anyone, you know, investing in anything to have it harm people or not be effective, as you said. And some companies have taken hits on their stock because of that. The payoff is so enormous. Mm-hmm. You know, for one drug to be a blockbuster drug, it could mean $1 million in profits a day. So it really is, those things are weighed, I'm sure. The profits that can be reaped are massive. And if one company had gotten a patent and sold insulin, for instance, that would probably be one of the richest companies in the world right now. That is what everyone's looking for, and they're looking for drugs that people will want to take and have to take over long term, because it just pays off if they hit. Now, they don't hit most of the time. You know, they put a lot of money in stuff that doesn't pay off, and I think they weigh it like anyone else would weigh anything. Mm-hmm. You know, and when Vioxx happened and other things happened, these drug companies and other companies, they've not gone out of business. They've taken some hits, but they're still chugging along, you know, and they will continue to chug along because people, the consumer in America and in other places, want their treatments and drugs. They demand them, and as long as they keep demanding them to the extent they do, companies will keep making them. However they need to make them, they will supply them. So, and that's cause and effect, and that's how the system works.
There, we got to leave it. We're out of time. Alex, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Certainly. Thank you.
Alex O'Meara is a freelance journalist. He is the author of Chasing Medical Miracles, The Promise and Perils of Clinical Trials. You'll find him online at www.alexomera.com, and he spells his name O-M-E-A-R. And there's a link to his website from our website, the Afternoon Magazine website at will.illinois.edu. His book, Chasing Medical Miracles, is published by Walker.